Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Joe Connison about the Clinton Foundation and Joe Connison's new book about Bill Clinton's post-White House years. It's called Man of the World, The Further Endeavors of Bill Clinton. Then we'll be joined by Robin Washington, who usually writes for the Boston Globe, but who had a piece this week at the Marshall Project about the future of policing in an age of driverless cars. Did you know that half of police work is pulling people over? I did not know that. Half of police work starts with pulling people over in their cars. But first, a couple of items you may have missed. Rudy Giuliani, you can't take him anywhere. Mayor 9/11 was asked to give a benign prep talk about leadership, because he knows all about leadership, to a financial trade group's annual awards for young Wall Streeters, according to the New York Observer, which I should note is published by Donald Trump's son-in-law. The Commercial Finance Association had to apologize to its members for Rudy's speech. In true Trump surrogate fashion, Giuliani apparently went off the rails and started ragging on the Mexicans who were supposedly working in the kitchen of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. The crowd was reportedly stunned by the remarks. They were stunned into silence. In the note of apology, the group featured a whole paragraph pointing out that they, and I quote, abhor discrimination of any kind, whether it is focused on race, age, or gender. According to the Observer, the apology was issued a day after, and I quote, Giuliani had been axed as the keynote speaker for a conference held by the International Council of Shopping Centers following letters from real estate professionals who deemed him divisive for his outspoken support of Trump. What a guy. So I guess his belligerence is costing him something on the speaking circuit, on the rubber chicken circuit. A 14-year-old African-American kid in Virginia will face criminal charges in November for stealing a 65-cent carton of milk from his high school. According to the Washington Post, Ryan Turk receives free school lunches, but he forgot to grab a carton of milk one day last year. He went back for it after getting his lunch, and a school police officer accused him of stealing it. According to the Post, the Ryan family and their lawyer, and I quote, allege that Ryan was discriminated against, targeted because he is a black teenager who did not want to go along with a police officer who they say was being unfair. A study released this week by researchers at Cambridge University found that police body cams do in fact cut down dramatically on the number of civilian complaints police officers receive. The study looked at 1.5 million hours of policing in four departments in the UK and two departments in the US, both of them in California, and found that in the year before the cops were equipped with body cams, they had 1,539 complaints filed against them. And in the year that they wore the cameras, that number dropped to just 113. So that was a reduction of 93%. I sometimes think that people reject body cameras because they're not perfect. We have seen police turn them off. We have seen them mysteriously not capture the action at hand during controversial contacts with citizens. But looking for any single magic bullet isn't wise, and saying we shouldn't pursue these body cameras because they are imperfect seems short-sighted to me. They obviously do a lot to constrain police officers. They don't magically make the problem of police abuse go away, but they reduce complaints dramatically, 93%. Finally, a note on the 2016 race. I don't want people to be complacent. It's important that people understand that Donald Trump can win. It's possible. And given the stakes, we should be frightened about that possibility, right? I mean, even if he has a 20% chance of winning or a 10% chance of winning, that's, things that have a 1 in 10 chance of happening do happen. But I know a lot of people who are just perpetually panicky about this race. They feel that Clinton should be way out ahead. And so I kind of feel an obligation to point out that while Trump can win, that while it's not outside the realm of possibilities, he's not going to. He's not going to win. Here's my own trick to staying calm during this election. And I have had my panicky moments myself, as I've mentioned in the past. But every day I start the day looking at the Huffington Post average of national polls. And every day I know that Trump support is below 44%. That is, on January 7th, Trump hit 44% in the Huffington Post's average of polls, of national polls. And he's been beneath that number every day since. Every day since January 7th, he's been below 44%. As of Saturday morning, he is at 42%, 42 point something. Now, it's not impossible for Trump to spend the entire year below 44% in the polling averages and then win. Among other things, the polls could all be wrong, right? The averages were off by 2.5 points in 2012. So who knows? It's an unusual election cycle, to say the least, but it's really, really unlikely, right? I think a lot of political reporters got burned saying that Trump could never win the nomination, right? They don't want to be wrong again. So we tend to overemphasize his prospects of victory. We make it into a horse race. Now, I wrote in August that Trump could become the nominee, and I laid out exactly how it could happen, and that is the way it did happen. So I feel more comfortable saying that Hillary Clinton is going to win this race. Trump's best chance of changing the structure of the campaign came and went with last week's first debate. Typically, the out party gains more in the first debate. The leader in the polls following the first debate has been the leader in the final polls going into the vote every election since 1976, 10 in a row. At this point, Trump, he's unpopular. He doesn't have a ground game. He is his own worst enemy. He will not stop picking fights with people and showing the world that he's unfit to be president. He will not stop doing that. He needs a miracle at this point, and it is very much Hillary Clinton's race to lose. Anyway, on that thought, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come right back with Joe Connison. Stay tuned. If it was my last day on earth, treat it like my first, go out the way I came in. So innocent, so pure, with no thoughts of insecurity, live life to the fullest, be what I wanna be. Last day on earth, I tell my mama don't cry, see my daddy in paradise, where the blind can see, the mute can talk, the cripple can walk. But for now, heaven's in New York. First thing I do is go back in time. Take the Twin Tower, put it back in the skyline. Tell my girl two wrongs still don't make it right. Make love for the last time under the candlelight. Pick up my homies, hit the gentleman club. After that, hit a pub, reminisce on the high school days. Man, I sucked as a quarterback. Remember getting sacked, man, I almost broke my back. When my last day on earth, treat it like my first, go out the way I came in. So innocent, so pure, with no thoughts of insecurity, live life to the fullest, be what I wanna be. Last day on earth, I tell my girl don't cry, but my daddy in paradise. Where the blind can see, the mute can talk, the cripple can walk. But for now, heaven's in New York. Man, get a people a tax break. Kids stop shooting, I can't sing in no more ways. I can't take the money with me, so I caught a movie.
Favorite actress, Angelina Jolie. Favorite singer, got to be Marley. Turn up the bass and move to the style.
I can't go without reading my
daughter bedtime story. The heavens is calling. With my last day on earth, treated like my first. Go out the way I came in. So when this is so pure, with no thoughts of insecurity, live life to the fullest, be what I wanna be. Last day on earth, tell my homies don't cry. With my dad in paradise. But the blind can see, the mute can talk, the cripple can walk. But for now, life is in your.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Joe Connison. Joe's a veteran journalist, a best-selling author. He's also the editor-in-chief of the National Memo. He was the author of The Hunting of the President, which is arguably kind of the seminal book on the right's decades-long obsession with the Clintons. And he has a new book out titled Man of the World, The Further Endeavors of Bill Clinton, which offers a timely look at Bill Clinton's post-presidency and the work of the Clinton Foundation. Joe Connison, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Good to be with you.
Folks, in the interest of disclosure, let me just note that Joe's an editor-at-large at the Nation Investigative Fund, which is a project of the Nation Institute, where I am a writing fellow. Joe has offered me some excellent words of advice on a couple of occasions, but we don't work together. The book isn't about the Clinton Foundation per se, but I think that's the issue that's most salient at this point in time. Joe, Bill Clinton was 54 when he left the White House. To what degree did his concept of life after the presidency, of what an ex-president should be, differ from his predecessors? You write that he was heavily influenced by Jimmy Carter and the mark that Carter made with the Habitat for Humanity and the Carter Foundation.
Yes. Clinton and Carter didn't always get along politically, to say the least, and their personalities were certainly very different. But there's no question that he had a great deal of respect for what President Carter did with the Carter Center, his human rights work, although they didn't always agree about everything he did then, but and certainly his charitable work, his work against river blindness in Africa. I think Clinton was inspired by all of that, and he invited Carter to visit him in Camp David before he left the White House in January 2001. So there was certainly an influence of President Carter. I think, he had made a study of the post-presidencies of the presidents who had done something significant after they left the White House, which included John Quincy Adams and William Taft and certainly Theodore Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover, among others. But I think his is different because of we live in a different time, and we live in a global age, and I think he is a unique personality. So his was certainly going to be different, and it was.
Now, the so-called Clinton rules, we've talked about this in the past when you were on the show. I think they've been a mainstay of reporting on the Clinton Foundation. There's been lots of innuendo about its donors getting special consideration from the State Department under Hillary Clinton. Can you kind of run down some of what the foundation has done since it was launched as a means of kind of setting the record straight? Tell us a little bit about Rwanda, for example, which ended up being one of Bill Clinton's biggest regrets in his presidency.
Yes. So let me just say the Clinton rules is a phrase that was invented by my co-author on The Hunting of the President, Gene Lyons, who lives in Arkansas, has been a journalist there for many years, and he's observed this phenomenon very closely. The foundation has done tremendous work, Josh, in not just in Africa, but certainly largely in Africa on public health issues. And a considerable amount of their energy has been focused in Rwanda. When President Clinton left the White House and wrote his memoir, he told me that Rwanda was his biggest regret. More than impeachment, more than a lot of other things that had happened, he felt worst about what had happened on his watch in Rwanda, which was, of course, the genocide in 1994. And he's been back there many times since then. He has apologized to the Rwandan people many times, so many times that I was at the home of the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, with him one day at a luncheon, and he started to apologize again when they were making their toasts. And Kagame said, you don't have to apologize anymore. He said, I'm still waiting for my first apology from the French, who were really responsible for this tragedy. So, and everybody kind of chuckled. But what Clinton has done in Rwanda, with great help from somebody who had been one of his harshest critics when he was president, Paul Farmer, on the public health front, they have rebuilt the Rwandan health system from the ground up. They've built teaching hospitals there. They've built hospitals in rural areas that are, you know, really world-class facilities. They have created all kinds of programs there to distribute low-cost or free treatment for HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other illnesses that afflict that country. So there's been a kind of across-the-board effort to raise health outcomes in Rwanda, and I think it's paid off. Rwanda has probably now the most modern and effective healthcare system in Africa.
Well, we can blame the media to some degree, but why don't people know about this stuff? The last time I had you on, Joe, I asked you why the campaign wasn't being more aggressive in pointing out the good works that the foundation has done. If you think about it, you know, there's nothing really wrong with taking rich people's money and investing it in healthcare for poor people. You said that we should expect a major push in that direction. It never really materialized. And frankly, I was a bit annoyed reading the book because I kept thinking, why isn't there like a war room pointing to some of the things that you talk about in your books?
Other people have told me. Yeah, other friends have said to me, I was reading your book and I loved it and it was fascinating, but it was making me so angry.
It made me angry. What are your thoughts on this? Why is this?
Well, so in some ways, Clinton is damned either way, because if he doesn't do a strong enough push on the public relations front for his foundation, then, as you said, people don't know enough about it. But if he gets out there and, let's say, started buying advertising to talk about the good works of the foundation, and taking the kinds of measures that, let's say, the Red Cross does, you know, or the United Way or any of these other foundations that, by the way, have been embroiled in really big scandals of their own, he would be attacked for using the foundation to promote himself and his wife's political ambitions. So there's kind of a cordon sanitaire around what they can actually do in terms of promoting the foundation's work. There is a public relations department in the foundation, and they do, you know, good work, you know, within their means. But I think he would not be comfortable spending a lot of the foundation's money on public relations and promotion in that way. They have, you know, they have gold ratings and you know, A-plus ratings from every charity watchdog group, and it's because they spend the money on the services, you know, like close to 90%, which is far above the average. So I think they don't want to be caught violating that. Now, could he go out and talk more about it? You know, he probably should. And I've noticed, you know, if you follow their Twitter stream now, for instance, you will see that they have been spending a great deal of energy trying to inform people about what the foundation is, trying to, you know, get people to click onto links to their website so they can read about its work. And they should do that. But I do think there are limitations to what they can do without drawing, you know, criticism for undue promotion.
Well, I have to tell you something. There's a number of times in the book where I thought, how come I haven't seen a surrogate on, you know, CNN talking about this? Why am I learning about things in your book when this issue is so front and center? You know what I'm saying?
The surrogates all need to read the book, first of all.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, you know, the funny thing is Clinton has always told me that, you know, in terms of donors and just people in general, that there were people who were only interested in the charitable work, and there were people who were only interested in the politics among all the huge universe of people that they know. And there was a small overlap of people who were quite interested in both. So lots of the political people who you now see out there, you know, stumping for Hillary Clinton, really don't know much about the work of the foundation. They've never gone to Africa with him or gone to Asia or the Caribbean with him or South America to see the projects. They don't have the kind of firsthand knowledge that, you know, a reporter like me would develop from, you know, going to Africa with him a few times and traveling elsewhere in the world with him. It's it takes an effort. You know, what is astonishing to me is that a major news organization, for instance, like the New York Times, and I talk about this in the book, you know, in 15 years, they really sent one reporter on a trip to Africa with him, Celia Duggar, who was an award-winning, you know, Africa correspondent, to see what he was doing. And the verdict that she came back with was very clear. You know, she had various critical things to say about his presidency and about him, but the work that they were doing, she said, was saving many, many lives, and she saw it herself. That was one story. Do you know how many stories there have been about emails? Do you know how many stories there have been about, you know, alleged, I don't know, something that supposedly happened with the foundation? You know, many of these stories are, and I go through some of this in the book towards the end, many of these stories are just unfounded, I mean, or made up. I'm sure you know, because you're a political journalist, about Judicial Watch, which puts out a lot of them. It is the group that obtained, you know, State Department emails and has put out some of the most damaging stories about the relationship between the foundation and the State Department. But some of them are just completely made up, and they rely on people's lack of knowledge about how the foundation works and what it's done. I'll give you my favorite example. They put out a press release claiming that the Crown Prince of Bahrain had given $32 million to the Clinton Global Initiative and had therefore been able to get a phone call to Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Now, there were several problems with this story. One was that the $32 million was never given to the Clinton Foundation. It was a what's called a commitment at the Clinton Global Initiative, where he stood up, the Crown Prince, and said, I'm going to spend $32 million on scholarships for Bahraini students to go to college. And that was a commitment, and it was announced there, and President Clinton put his arm around him and congratulated him, and that was it. Not a dime of that money, or even a penny, went to the Clinton Foundation or the Clinton Global Initiative. That was in 2005 at the first meeting of the Clinton Global Initiative. Flash forward 5 years. Hillary Clinton is now Secretary of State, and the Crown Prince of Bahrain asks to see her because he's going to be in Washington. She had broken her arm not too long before that and wanted, you know, was not taking visitors that day. So there was some back and forth email traffic about whether she was going to see him or not. This was turned into a press release which said, by 2010, the Crown Prince of Bahrain had given $32 million to the Clinton Global Initiative and therefore he was going to get a meeting. It was all nonsense. The Crown Prince of Bahrain, who's the head of state of one of the most crucial allies of the United States in the Persian Gulf, was going to get a meeting sooner or later with the Secretary of State if that's what he wanted. And it wouldn't matter if he had given $32 million or 32 cents to the Clinton Foundation. But he hadn't given that money. But they put out a press release that makes this claim, and it's published by reputable news sources. Politico published it. They had to eventually publish a correction. But by then, it's out there in the ozone, you know, of political discourse, and it does damage. People believe it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of innuendo, as I said earlier. There's on the left too. There's a whole rash of stories about weapons sales, weapons deals following donations to the Clinton Foundation, and I mean,
well, the best one of those is the one about Saudi Arabia, which, of course, had given money to the Clinton Foundation, just as they've given money to every presidential foundation to build the libraries. They built every presidential library since they started building them, pretty much, the Saudi. But the weapons deal that was put forward by some writers as, you know, an example of this from Saudi was made by George W. Bush years before. And the deliveries of weapons were, continued through the Obama administration. By the way, the Secretary of State does not decide who gets weapons from the United States. unilaterally by
any stretch. It's a multi-agency process.
The president decides. The president decides. If they are going to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia or any important ally of the United States, that is decided in the National Security Council with the advice of the Pentagon. And they may ask the Secretary of State's opinion, but he or she is not going to control who gets any weapons. So this is a fabrication, and I have to say it's really sad to see progressive publications, progressive journalists invent this in order to defame, you know, somebody who they consider a political opponent. I expect that from Judicial Watch, because I've seen them do it for more than 20 years. I don't expect that from journalists, liberal journalists, who are supposed to believe in facts.
Well, yeah, I'm coming increasingly to expect that stuff. So, on the other hand, I think you do a good job in the book of shooting down a lot of the kind of Clinton Cash stuff. Clinton Cash, listeners will remember, was the book by Peter Schweitzer that alleged widespread corruption, was picked up by a lot of mainstream outlets.
Still hoping to debate Peter Schweitzer, who wrote that, someday. You know, he had one chance to debate me on a public radio show, and he ran away.
I am not surprised.
I'm looking for him.
But Joe, at the same note, I feel like the Clintons sometimes are not as cautious about avoiding the appearance of conflicts of interest as I would be if I were the subject of a 30-year smear campaign. You know.
Well, Josh, you know, if you've read the book, you know I agree with that, because I say that in the book.
Yes, I do.
I think it was foolish to go and take big speaking fees from Goldman Sachs, no matter how much she might like some people there or know people who are there who used to be in government or whatever the reason was. They have a program that I know she and others admire, helping women entrepreneurs. That's fine. But, you know, as you said, the appearance was very damaging to her, and it certainly wasn't worth it. The same thing goes for some other big donors. The funny thing is, you know, as I mentioned in the book, when she left the State Department and she was signed up by the Harry Walker Agency, which represents her husband, and, you know, her husband has been the biggest attraction they've ever had there, she told them, "I don't want to do any foreign speeches." And if you look at the list of her speeches, there are no foreign. You know, he's going abroad all the time and giving speeches. She didn't do a single one, and the reason was she thought that would have a bad appearance. So it's not like they never think about this. It's just not easy to predict what will be, at least from their point of view, what will be the most, you know, what will cause the most troubling appearance, I guess. But, you know, the other thing I would say about all of that is when President Obama asked her to become Secretary of State, in the autumn of 2008, she turned him down at first, and I go through this in the book. She actually prepared a press release explaining why she wasn't accepting his offer. Then, you know, gradually, over the course of a couple of weeks, he wore her down. She changed her mind. She decided, as many patriotic people do, that when the president asks you to do something, you need to do it. And she said to him, "Mr. President-elect, what do I do about my husband's foundation? Because he's going to continue to do this work. He's saving, at this point, millions of lives every year, and we he's not going to shut it down so that I can be Secretary of State." And President-elect Obama said to her, "We will work out an understanding about that." And they spent weeks negotiating a deal that laid out the parameters under which President Clinton could continue to operate the foundation, continue to raise money abroad, continue to give speeches abroad. And under various circumstances, these things had to be cleared with the State Department ethics officer. But, you know, if people have a complaint about how this was done, they need to take it up with President Obama as much as anybody else, because they acceded to everything he asked. He asked them, for instance, "Josh, you have to disclose all of your donors, not just the ones at the present, not just the future ones. Everybody who's ever given money to you must be disclosed." Now, you know, from one point of view, that's a totally reasonable demand. From another point of view, they had assured all these previous donors that they weren't going to be disclosed because donors to private foundations are not disclosed as a rule. For instance, we don't know who any of the donors to Judicial Watch are.
Right.
So the Clintons sent a letter to all the previous donors and said, we're going to have to disclose your donations. And you know what? Not one of them objected. It was that all went over fine, and they disclosed them all, and there were 300,000 of them, on a list on their website. So to the extent that people have a problem with how this was done, they need to address President Obama and say, well, you should have made it stricter, or you should have told them they couldn't do this, or maybe you shouldn't have made her Secretary of State. But he wanted her to be Secretary of State not because she didn't know anybody, not because she'd never done anything, but just the opposite of that. He wanted somebody as Secretary of State who could do the job without a lot of, guidance or everyday input from the White House, because he was going to focus on the economy and trying to get a big stimulus package through the Congress, which was not easy. So he asked her, she did it, and she did it under the conditions that the president set forth.
I mean, that gets back to the appearances, right? I mean, there are people in various positions, sensitive positions, judges, attorneys, who go out of their way, even when there is no impropriety, to avoid the appearance of such. And some of Clinton's defenders say, look, there's nothing that they can do. Whatever they do, there'll be made up scandals and controversies, and the right will cook something up. And I think
Did you say non-controversy?
Non-controversy.
I like that.
It's a non-controversy.
Yes, I've seen 100 non-controversies.
And I think that the answer to that is Obama. Obama has been the subject of a similar campaign to delegitimize his presidency. And what he's given them is nothing. Nothing that is not. So he's left them with birth certificates and kooky conspiracy theories that even the New York Times, which is a regular character in your book,
right,
would not pick up,
remain
bubbling in the fever swamps.
Yeah, I would say I think that's good, and I admire President Obama greatly. I'm a big admirer of him, not only for that reason, but for many other reasons. But I would say they treat the Clintons differently than they treat anybody else in politics, including people who have big scandals that ought to be examined. Do you know how many emails disappeared from the Bush White House? Just disappeared, in spite of the Presidential Records Act and all the other things that are held up, to indict Hillary Clinton for her use of a private server and getting rid of some of the personal emails or emails that she deemed personal. 22 million emails. What do you think was in those emails? I'll tell you what was in some of them. One of the people who made use of a private server and then got rid of a lot of his emails was Karl Rove. They used this server at the Republican National Committee, even though they were in the White House. This is completely against the law. And one of the people who he was communicating with, or his office was communicating with all the time, was Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who went to prison for fraud and corruption. So you tell me, what was in those emails? I will never know. Colin Powell got rid of all of his emails. He's now being held to account for this a little bit because of my book, really, and what I wrote about his advice to Hillary Clinton about emails. But nothing like what's happened to her.
Yeah, it's
nothing
true.
Nothing like what's happened to her.
Well, that's the Clinton rules.
So, you can't really say, well, if they'd acted differently, it might be different. It may be, but there's really no reason to believe that.
Let me ask you a final question before I let you go. And I've taken more time than I had requested, so I appreciate your hanging in there with me. I want to ask about a criticism from the left that I think is fairly on point. There's this common claim is that Clinton's left of center supporters are adopting a standard where we need to show an actual quid pro quo to claim that money is exerting an undue influence on people in power. That's a standard we don't use when we look at, big oil contributing to Republican from Texas. Isn't it the case that, you know, at least some of these big donors to the foundation were looking for access that ordinary people could never get? And is that something that we should just overlook?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I'll tell you, there are different ways to approach that. You know, I've heard Charlie Rose asked Clinton about that the other day, and he said he couldn't really assess the motivation of all of the 300,000 donors, many of whom give like $100 or less, many, many of them. But certainly many of them give millions. And were any of them motivated by a desire to influence him or her? And the answer is, he had no way of knowing that, but if he had to guess, he would say probably some of them were. But that doesn't matter unless you can show that they got something for it. So, I mean, because you can talk about anybody's motivation, Josh, and you can't really know it unless they, you know, write it down somewhere. So, you know, I don't worry about it that much. The other part of it is, as you said earlier, it's good to take rich people's money, and by rich people I mean everybody from the Saudi king to, you know, the head of, you know, a big corporation in the United States. It's good to take those people's money and put it to work buying, you know, cheap generic AIDS drugs to keep people alive in Africa. And I've seen them. I've seen those people. I've seen people who were began to get these drugs, you know, in 2005, and I saw them again in 2013, and they were still alive. And there are millions of them. So when I weigh, you know, those millions of lives against somebody's, you know, perception at a Washington media outlet that they're concerned about the appearance that they don't like, I find that to be one of the easiest moral choices I've ever confronted in my life. That takes me a nanosecond to figure out which is more important.
Joe Connison, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
I appreciate it. It was fun.
Folks, the book is called Man of the World, The Further Endeavors of Bill Clinton, and it's available from Simon & Schuster. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back.
Say, I remember when we used to sit in a government yard in Brooklyn. About solving the crookedness as it mingle with the good people we meet. Good friends we had, oh, good friends we've lost along the way. In this great future, you can't forget your past. So dry your tears, I say, to my peeps who passed away. No woman, no cry. No woman, no cry. Say, say, say. Oh, hey, little sister, don't shed no tears. No woman, no cry. Say, say, say. I remember when we used to rock. Project Yard in Jersey. And little Georgie would make the fire light as stolen cars passed through the night.
Welcome back. This is Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. And we're joined now by Robin Washington, who is a transportation columnist for the Boston Globe. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joshua. Great to be here.
Robin had a fascinating piece this week at the Marshall Project, not at the Boston Globe, but the Marshall Project, looking at policing in an era of driverless cars. You should check it out. First of all, you should check out the Marshall Project in general. They do excellent nonprofit journalism on criminal justice issues. But check out Robin's piece. It's titled Driverless Cars Are Coming. What does that mean for policing? And you can read it at the Marshall Project.org. That's all one word. Are police agencies already planning for a driverless future?
Not much. That's what some of the consultants who I talked to said. They're a little bit aware of it now, a little bit more than they were. One gentleman said he was talking about this stuff 10 years ago, and they looked at him like he had three heads or so. Now you had the Google crash, and unfortunately the Tesla crash, and it's on their radar screen. But he points out that a lot of people seem to be looking toward retirement before all this happens.
So just get me out of policing before everybody's driving around in computerized cars. So
Right. You
write that we can say goodbye to high-speed chases and roadside stops. Is the premise here that we'll have self-driving cars that can't be programmed to exceed the posted speeding limits? Is this like a dystopian future for those of us with a lead foot, or will speed limits perhaps be increased when the cars are smart enough to drive themselves?
They could be both, and I'm glad you said the word premise, because one of the things when I did the story, I found people who were policing. There's a group called the Police Futurists or Police Futures Society, and so I said the premise here is that they have taken over. This is at least 10 to 30 years from now, when driverless cars are the norm or pretty much everything out there on the street. And the reason I say the premise, we don't know exactly what will happen, but I have to tell you, they are here already. If you have a car, 2015, 2016, Honda, for instance, a Honda Civic 2016, let alone a Tesla, and it has three main features: adaptive cruise control, which means it can follow the person in front of you and accelerate or decelerate on its own; lane assist, which means it can steer on its own; and collision avoidance. That's basically a driverless car. It can do all the stuff that's called driving. The problem is integrating it into the environment. So if there's a stop sign, if there's a stop signal, if there's a pedestrian, if there's a little kid chasing a ball in the street, that's got to be worked out. And of course, that's vitally important. And the nuances are, even when it gets to the higher degrees of, like, there is a red light, but there's a policeman waving you through. And so it's going to take a while for all that to be worked out. The second part of the premise is, why am I saying, well, okay, these will be here running around and people will be inside and there's no reason for a police stop, is it's very likely that we won't own these things, because one of the big points is they don't have to park. They drive by themselves. So they take you to work, Joshua, and they come and get me and take me somewhere and then take somebody else shopping. It doesn't make a lot of sense for you to have bought that car as a traditional car for it, unless you want to be our benefactor, Joshua, which is perfectly fine. It doesn't make a lot of sense for you to buy that to support everybody else traveling all day. So the models that are out there are either the companies would own them and maybe have some kind of shared lease program, or good old Uber or Lyft or something like that, which is why they're very much interested in these things. And because of that, it changes the entire dynamic of you're driving around and a cop is driving around and, you know, you're interacting with each other.
So, first of all, I read in your piece, you point out that riders in driverless cars probably won't own the vehicles. And one thing that struck me is that cars are part of our identity. They're, it's not clear to me that the driverless aspect of cars would lead to a future where we don't have private vehicle ownership. I would think that a lot of people would still want to own their own cars, if for no other reason than as a marker of status.
Well, that's true. And that's where I say, I go back to the word premise, and we don't know what will
right.
happen. The other work, by the way, I've done on this and kind of extensively, and has aired this week on WGBH Radio in Boston. And if you go to WGBH.org, I'm pretty sure, and type in driverless, they all pop up. We had a five-part series ended today on every aspect of this. So if you want great detail, your listeners can join our listeners, and we could all have a great listening party. But quite seriously, we look at all the different aspects of this. So we don't know, you know, exactly what will happen. But if they're running around all day, the ownership would change. Oh, the other part is the demographics. We had one piece looking at the demographics of it, and different generations look at these things differently. So I'm in the baby boomer generation, just the tail end of that. We're the ones clinging to our cars. Our entire identity is wrapped around cars. I have a Miata, by the way, and that's called baby, and it's called baby for a reason. You know?
Nice.
And the whole purpose of having a Miata is to drive it. You don't have a driverless Miata. In fact, it's a stick shift. I wouldn't even get a automatic Miata, you know. but the generation ahead of me, you know, the people who are now in assisted living or whatever, my generation has been taking away their keys. And they love the idea of not having to worry about me anymore and going to wherever they want to go. Likewise, on the other end, millennials aren't quite growing up the same way that my generation did. So they're the people in the cities who don't have cars at all, who have been Ubering from day one or taking Lyft or whatever, who are better users of public transit, although I'm a big fan of public transit myself. And so the attitudes are not necessarily what you think they would be. And lastly, I interviewed people at some of the auto shows, and I have this one gentleman who says, nope, don't want them, middle age, not a little younger than baby boomer, but middle age. And, well, he's saying he doesn't want them. He's sitting there looking at a car that has what? Everything I just said, adaptive cruise control, lane assist, and collision avoidance. You know, he's looking at a car that is driverless, whether he wants it or not. It's almost like saying, I don't want power steering. Or, you know, I don't want windshield wipers. All these things that came in were innovations at the time, and they didn't seem to be necessary. And now we take them for granted. The other one, by the way, is people saying, I wouldn't ride in one. Well, I would say 50 years ago, certainly 75 years, people said, I would never get into an elevator without an elevator operator.
Right, or take an airplane 80 years ago. I think that for me, the crucial difference is whether it has the option to drive manually. I would not say I will never get into a driverless car, but I feel like I would never buy a car that I couldn't, you know, for me, I want to have that option to have a car that can drive me home safely after a few drinks, but I would never want to give up that manual mode where I can, you know, I have a convertible and I can put the top down and go driving, you know?
Right. Well, you and me too with the Miata. I'm not going to give up baby, you know.
Right.
But I may have to take baby to a track or something. I mean, we don't know. You know, I'm not about to speculate like that. And even though I've written an awful lot about this, I'm, you know, not going to put money on the whole thing.
Sure.
But this is a scenario that's out there. And the people who are putting money on it are the automakers more than anybody else. They really have reinvented themselves as tech companies, and they are putting billions into it. It's quite impressive, for lack of a better word. I haven't seen anything like this since the Manhattan Project, which I didn't see personally. And the other thing that's different about that was government money or the space race. And in this case, this is all private money where they realize this stuff is happening and they're doing it. You know, the U.S. head of Volvo was on a radio program today, and he was saying they're going to have fully autonomous cars out there in 5 years. He said they actually could be sooner, but he said he wanted to be conservative. Ford said the same thing. But the interesting thing he said was, actually, we could outfit your car much sooner than that. There will be kits to make your car driverless before that. And so what he's saying is, again, the technology is there. And what we want to do with it as a society is kind of up to us and kind of up to either the marketing or the price point. You know, you and I like driving, but do we necessarily like getting the oil change or better? I have this, and I'm not advocating, I'm just giving a point. On my wife's car, the license plate fell off, well, in back. And this was when she was going to work. I took about 3 bungee cords, extended around the back of the hatch of a Kia Sportage, looked like an idiot. But the reason I did this was, do I want to go to jail taking my wife to work because I'm driving around without a license plate in back, you know? And so that's the kind of stuff that Yeah, or if you sit there in, you know, a repair shop and they come back and they say $400, your mind starts thinking about alternatives. So I think that the automakers are banking that the younger generation is much more amenable to those alternatives, and you know, and they'll be embracing them.
I have to say this way, I love driving, and I do like owning a car. When I lived in San Francisco, I used it's called City Car Share, and it is a fleet. You basically make a reservation on your iPhone or whatever, use an app to make a reservation, and they give you this little key fob that opens the door of the car, and they had these pods of cars. This still exists in San Francisco, and you pay $6 an hour, $7 an hour for the car that you're, while you're using it. Each pod has its own parking spaces, so they'll take a piece of a garage somewhere, and throughout the city there are these pods where they'll have a Prius, which is kind of the mainstay of their fleet, but they also have a pickup truck if you need to go and pick up some furniture or something. They often have an SUV in case you're driving a bunch of people or picking up a bunch of groceries. And the beauty of it is that you didn't have to worry about anything. They maintain the cars. They dealt with the insurance. They've, you know, you just had to make your reservation and pick up your car for a couple of hours. It was really, really nice, actually. And, you know, having right. those parking spots everywhere was super convenient. I had one right on my corner. So I can see doing that certainly in cities. A lot of people do live in more rural areas where there's far greater, you know, distances to drive to get to the vet or the doctor or whatever. It's a different climate. I think cars generally represent something different in rural America than they do in urban America. They represent freedom as much as anything else. Let's go back to policing for a moment.
One thing about that very quickly, though, is in our demographics piece, we did that. We did young, old, urban, rural. And it's funny, there was a urban person who said, well, I can see them for rural areas, but not the city. And there was a rural person who said, or actually the opposite. But in any case, both were pointing to the other side. And the rural people, it was somebody, a couple from Grand Forks, North Dakota, who drive regularly to Minneapolis. I've done that drive. You don't want to do it. It just goes boring on and on and on forever. And he said there would be nothing better than a driverless car. So, you know, it depends what you're doing with it or where you are, but I think the grass might be greener on either side.
I mean, you can see a huge amount of productivity gains if you can work while you're driving to work, or, you know, you can write up a memo on your laptop or whatever. But let's get back to policing for a moment. I didn't realize how large a share of police work is just pulling over people for speeding or busted taillights or whatever. You write that it's about 50% of what police do. And my question is, wouldn't this be a really great boon to communities of color who are often pulled over for driving while black? Seems to me the fewer contacts would presumably lead to fewer confrontations, fewer shootings of unarmed motorists. It seems like this would be an unalloyed good for those communities, huh?
Right. So if you took everything we just said and said forget about it, and you gave communities of color that one benefit you're talking about there, they'd embrace it in about a second, you know. So, yeah, there's no question about that, that would be a game changer. And it's sad because, you know, you think that we're in the year 2016, we should be mature and figure out all this stuff and learn how to get along. And, well, I guess we haven't. But if technologically it becomes obsolete, so be it. It's sort of like segregation. You know, would segregation in the South had made any sense in a 2016 economy where you have shopping malls? Can you imagine, you know, a 21st century mall, and it has all this opulence and everything, and what, they got to have four bathrooms? You know, who would want to pay for that, right? You know, so.
Now, in the piece you talk about automated cameras at stoplights, and that seems like just a kind of precursor for the kinds of capabilities law enforcement could adopt in a driverless society. What kind of new tools are the police likely to embrace in this driverless future?
So that's the question. I mean, there's I think it's an example of how these things happen gradually and we don't even notice they're happening. Another model, I threw out the elevator a little while ago, but is your cell phone, is our iPhone devices and smartphones. They do all kinds of things now that 10 years ago you would never have thought of. You thought they were just a phone and maybe a BlackBerry kind of thing. Well, my bike speedometer, the other thing I do is ride a bicycle and enjoy it very much. And I used to buy a bike computer that was at least, the cheap ones were $30, usually $100 or something. It's a $1.99 app on my phone. And it tells me how fast I'm going, my entire route, my average speed, and you guess, name it. I would never have dreamed that that would have been disrupted and displaced by my phone. So these things happen gradually, and red light cameras are exactly that. I mean, they came in, and, well, they're enforcing that one red light, but now here you can get into civil liberties issues, and please do. They can be doing all kinds of other things. There's speeding cameras. They're used to find out if in law enforcement, oh, wait a minute, that blue truck was over there at that road at that time, And so don't expect that these things won't be used more and more and more. I mean, the fact is, and we're learning for better and for worse, the whole thing with police video, it's not just the body cameras and the dash cams. It's every cam. There's the cam that was on the corner. It was the cam at the convenience store. So your moves and the police officer's moves, too, and everything going on in broad daylight is pretty much being recorded.
And
that will be a law enforcement tool.
And in the piece, Robin talks about the potential for police to turn off cars remotely if they're fleeing a crime, et cetera, et cetera. What about the flip side of this? I think history shows that, as police adapt to new technologies, criminals do as well.
It's the other way around. That's exactly,
criminals do it first.
Right. But Dillinger, for instance, came up with the idea of he didn't invent the police chase. He did inadvertently, but, he said, hey, look at these car things. This is a cool way to get away from a bank, right? What were the cops doing? They were using Keystone Cop kind of vans, right, to take the cops from one station to the other or just to a situation or whatever. Nothing was meant to be for speed, and this guy's, he's in central Wisconsin in about an hour after leaving Chicago. And they said, oh, so they invent the squad car, or they invent the high-speed pursuit vehicle. And but yes, you're right. They tend to follow. So this is the dark side of what I wrote, and the kind of scary side is one criminal, or even worse, terroristic aspect of all this stuff is a driverless car could be used for terrorism. Somebody could put a bomb in there. I hesitate even saying this, but, it's been out there, and police have been warned about it to look for it. The FBI has a warning. Someone could put a bomb in a driverless car, and guess what? You now have a suicide bomber where you don't need a human being to do the suicide. That's not a good thing. And so some kind of response, I have no idea what it would be, needs to be made to them.
Yeah, and you also talk about the potential to use driverless cars to traffic in illegal goods. Robin Washington, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week.
You're quite welcome. And let's come back in 10 or 30 years and see how accurate we were. And if I'm wrong, okay, I don't mind. I'll give you a ride in the Miata. I'll keep it.
I'll take you up on that. I'd also like to thank Joe Connison. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud or anywhere else where you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I would also like to thank Digby and Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their places. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.